basically what I want to do tonight is look at four models of forgiveness as outlined by Professor Moshe Halbertal of the University. And I want to do that around the following thesis, which is that doing something wrong and apologizing for it and getting forgiveness for it are not a simple matter. And my thesis is that every act of apology and forgiveness involves an exchange. It involves an exchange between the person who was injured and the person who did the injuring. And each of them makes a calculation about what they're willing to give up in order to get something from the other person. So for the injured party, that would be, what am I willing to forego in order to get what I want? And for the injurer, it would be, what am I willing to do in order to get pardon from the other party? And we'll see this very clearly in the four models that we have ahead of us. Let's begin with the first approach. I'm sorry for those of you who have kind of a mucky photocopy, but first approach embodied in ancient Greek tradition, Aristotelian, Epicurean, and Stoic. Right? So this is called Stoic forgiveness. And we know that Stoicism because it entered the English language, and when we say somebody is approaching something stoically, we mean that basically they're kind of impassive, that they're bearing up under it without a great deal of emotion, that their desire is mostly for control. Stoic forgiveness is an interesting model because what it means is that you're willing to forgive the person without any conditions. And not because you're this wonderful human being, but because what you want in this exchange more than anything else is you want to be free of this person. Right? In other words, you want independence from them. And why don't you have independence from them? Because they're taking up space in your brain. Because you're occupied by them. Because even though you are the one who is injured, part of the problem is that you obsessively think about them all the time. So your act of pardon here is really an act of severance. What you want is to not have to do anything with them anymore, and you believe that if you forgive them, that you can go your own separate ways. Right? You can see that in like really trivial examples every day, and usually this model only works well with people that you don't really need to see again, that you have no hope of reconciliation with. So, you know, you're on the in the parking lot and somebody taps your fender and there's no real damage either way, and you just say, fine, it's okay. Right? That's a classic Stoic act, really, because you don't want to have anything to do with them. You're in a hurry, you don't want them in your life, you just want to be free of them. So that's a really trivial example. Now, there can be more important examples, and those examples are actually quite poignant, meaning that people may spend their lives not thinking in this way, and they may come to this only as a kind of concession, and you'll see what I mean in a minute. For most people, this is not really the model they operate on a priori. They want something more. And in my opinion, the thing that most people want more than anything else, more than even an apology, is they want validation. They want validation for their narrative. In other words, you did this to me, and it's not just that I want you to say I'm sorry. I want you to recognize that I'm right. I want you to recognize that you did this. And perhaps the starkest example in the 20th century of this, on a political scale, are what are called truth and reconciliation commissions. Right, of which there were several countries that had this, after long periods of human rights abuse. Perhaps the most famous in recent years took place in South Africa. Many of you may be familiar that between 1948 and 1994, there was a system of government-sponsored racial segregation known as apartheid, which only fell with the agreement that Prime Minister de Klerk made with the newly freed Nelson Mandela. And 2 years later, in 1996, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission was set up as a form of transition, since it was clear to everybody that given the kind of feelings of suppressed rage and feelings of injustice the majority black populace had towards the minority Afrikaans rulers, that what could happen would be a bloodbath. That in fact there would be a massive retaliation of violence that would rip the country apart. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was organized to allow those people who were victimized to stand up and testify in public to the wrongs that they had endured, the injustices, the abuses, the tortures. It also invited, and this was more controversial, it invited other people who had perpetrated those kinds of injustices to stand up and say, yes, I did this and this, and often be immune from prosecution because that was the deal that got made. Now, what's important here is that the key to it was this validation process. In other words, that not only would the person get up and say, this is what happened to me, but their actual abuser, injurer, would come up and say, yes, I did this and this and this. For many people, and Helmer Tall points this out at the bottom of the first page, for many people, the process of validation is the key. Because, as he argues here, without it, you feel isolated. You feel like your narrative is your own. Nobody believes you. In fact, you may begin to feel a little bit crazy, like nobody believes me. And so there's a double injustice that occurs. The first is from the wrong you got in the first place, and the second is that nobody is actually confirming that the wrong was done to you. You will see this in publicly available transcripts of rape cases in the United States and Canada, where not only was the woman raped, but the man will come to trial and say, no, of course it was consensual, your version is wrong. So there, one of the key quests for the woman in that situation is not simply that the person say, you know, I'm sorry or whatever it is, but to actually have her version, her narrative of her life confirmed by somebody, because otherwise it's incredibly isolated. I would say on a less dramatic scale, we're not talking about, you know, South Africa or rape victims, we're talking about our lives. I think this is actually one of the key processes of any relationship over a long term, and it's certainly to me the key process of marriage. Because if you think about it, when people get into dispute with one another, what each party is really looking for is the validation of how they feel, not just the surrender to the pressure that gets exerted when you say, you hurt me. And I want to explain what the difference is between the two. In what I consider a lesser scenario, in other words, not a good scenario, one will say to the other, the first party will express their hurt, and the second party will say, I'm not really sure I understand what you're talking about, or they'll say, well, if what I did made you feel that, right? And we all have our versions, and we all know what our versions are. This kind of language, that's the language of invalidation. What it's saying is, I'll give you an apology, but I will not redeem the narrative. Try this one out for size and see if you've ever heard it before. One party says, that really hurt me, and the other party says, you're being so sensitive. Why are you so sensitive? I was just a joke. Whatever sort of language you use, that's the language of invalidation. Every day, all the time. In fact, in many cases, people are continuously invalidating each other, and the other party has to make a decision about how long they'll wait for validation. In serious cases, where the invalidation isn't just, you know, you can't take a joke, but rather, you've completely misinterpreted our life together. Or, no, those 20 motels credit card slips with that blonde were really because we were having a business meeting, or whatever you want to say. When the invalidation becomes severe, then I think that's where people fall in crisis, and they have a very important decision to make, which is to either keep plowing on for validation, or at some point, perhaps, to pop up to the first model. You know, that would sound like something like, you know what, the person's a brick wall. I'm never going to get anywhere with them. I just have to accept it. I just have to be stoic about it. I just have to, you know, or leave. Right? Your choices are to opt out. We're to switch to stoic forgiveness, in which you're trying to achieve a kind of mental separation from the person, but you've given up on validation. And the truth is that giving up on validation is a very, very poignant moment. Because it's something that many of us wait for our whole lives, right? We're waiting to be validated, and if you've been waiting and waiting, and then there's a sort of moment of recognition, this isn't going to happen. So that's quite painful, and the choice may be to pop up to that first model of stoic forgiveness. Let's take a little bit of a look at what Professor Helbertal writes about truth and reconciliation on the bottom paragraph of the first page, the fourth one. He writes, as the first stage in the forgiveness process, the injurer making his confession before the injured becomes his partner in describing what transpired between them and in considering the events to have been a crime. That point in the process treats a painful aspect of the victim's consciousness, for more than a few victims feel isolated in their reading and assessment of their situation. Not only have they been wronged, they've also been denied recognition of that wrong, a denial that undermines their sense of reality and transforms their cries into a sort of madness. The injurer's participation in the description and assessment of the episode entails an important first step in the emergence of the injury. Under the heavy weight of isolation that compounds his pain, the perpetrator stands before the victim and declares the latter's reading of reality to have been correct. As you say, thus and such happened, and a wrong was indeed done here, etc. So that's the process of validation, whether it is on a large-scale dramatic situation or a daily one in our lives. Now, the third approach on the fact side of the first page is what Halbertal calls forgiveness as understanding. This, to me, is actually the most mature form of forgiveness, because it entails a certain kind of reciprocity. In other words, when you forgive through understanding, it's like saying, I forgive you, but not only that, but kind of begin to see the position you were in, why you did it. Perhaps I might have done the same thing under similar circumstances. It involves a certain kind of empathy with the injurer and the ability to see it as part of a more mature process, because in truth, many disputes are reciprocal on some level. Now, I would argue, Halbertal doesn't say this, but I would argue that it's almost impossible after being injured to jump to this type of forgiveness. I think that people can only do it after they go through the second step, which is validation. You'll notice in disputes between people, especially intimates, now, once somebody validates the other in a good situation, you'll notice that the other party will then suddenly say, and you know what? I can also kind of see like what I might have done here, right? It's very hard for them to do that without getting a prior validation. Once they get their narrative confirmed, like, I did this to you, so then it becomes easier for that other party to say, and you know what? I might have done stuff to you too. So, forgiveness as understanding usually follows, I would think, in the wake of the restorative forgiveness that Halbertal talks about in the second model. However, as he goes on to point out, to be able to understand in this way requires certain prerequisites. The first one, he says, is the ability to split the doer from the deed. So that would mean that when the person did something to you, and you know, you can all think in the privacy of your mind somebody who has done something hurtful to you. And the decision you had to come to at that point, I guess, would be something like, he lied to me, but he's not a liar. She cheated on me, but she's not basically an adulteress, and so on. This is a very important decision to come to, especially if you're with somebody in close quarters, and it's actually something that we face as we grow older, but it's especially acute, I think, at a certain point in youth, when you're making critical life decisions, right? If you're with somebody and you have to decide, do I want to marry this person, and they do something, you have to think about, is this constitutive of their character? Is this telling me something that this isn't just what they do, it's who they are? And so I can't make that do or deed split. And that is absolutely seminal and being able to forgive somebody in this way, right? If you feel like they're just a repeat offender, and you feel like it's not just something that you can say, yes, I know you did it, but it's not really a part of who you are, it makes the forgiveness almost impossible. And one of the examples that Halbertal cites here is that it's very hard to do this with, like, radically evil people. It's hard to look at Nazis or pedophiles, etc., and make a do or deed split, because the key to making a do or deed split is to be able to imagine empathically that you might have been able to do the same thing, right? Nobody can look at Adolf Eichmann and say that. Nobody can look at a pedophile and say that. So in essence, you're really saying you are what you did, and therefore I can't empathize with you and I cannot forgive you. So therefore, in understanding the person and coming to a mature reciprocity where you can say, I can see how that happened and I might have done it too. Again, you have to make that do or deed split. You have to decide whether you could imagine yourself doing the same thing and so on. But if you're capable of doing it, it's probably the most mature form of forgiveness, right? And let's take a look at the bottom of this page. The last 8 lines. I think this is well put by Professor Hoppenthal. He says, this sort of forgiveness requires a combination of maturity and personal empathy. The victim must shed the self-righteousness that often accompanies the status of a victim. And sometimes when he discovers his own contribution to what transpired, he will learn to reinterpret and read anew what happened to him and to the injurer. Okay, so let's talk about that for a second. And again, I think this works better if you all think about the situation that you're currently in or have been in, where there's a certain kind of impasse, a certain kind of dispute. And forgiveness is really the goal, but it's a difficult goal. What he's pointing out here is that on some level, sometimes subtle, sometimes more overt, when you hurt somebody, they can actually take that hurt and they can move with it to the moral high ground, and they like to stay there. It doesn't invalidate the fact that you hurt them, but he's pointing out, I think very insightfully, that perching on that high ground is a form of power. And what do you have? You have the power of righteousness. Like, you hurt me. Not the other way around, and I can hold that over you for as long as I like. And you can do that. In other words, strict justice on your side. You did do it. You did do that to me. But what Hoppenthal is pointing out is that if you really want to get to reconciliation, if you want to get to mature forgiveness, so you actually have to take a step off the perch. You have to sort of shelve the self-righteousness for a minute. You have to believe in the possibility that at any given moment, we could also do things that aren't so nice. And you forget. Because if you're invested in maintaining the power of the moral perch, you won't like to forget, because that already now evens things out. You like the fact that the other person is at some level indebted to you, and there can even be a cruelty there, right, that happens. So all of these things go into this exchange. Right? You have to give up the sense of your own moral superiority in order to actually make this exchange work. Just as in the first case, the injurer has to give up his power by validating the narrative of the person that they injured. Okay. Am I clear so far? All right. Good. And again, there's a category here of what Hoppenthal calls the unforgiven, right, which is radical evil. There's no way of moving towards a space there where the person could be forgiven. Their actions are not part of that domain.
Can I just ask you,
who is Hoppenthal? Moshe Hoppenthal is professor of philosophy at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Now, the fourth type that he describes is actually interesting to me. He calls it forgiveness as grace. It's on the next page, the bottom paragraph. Forgiveness as grace, which in many ways seems somewhat Christian, it seems to be the model of Jesus Christ, is the notion of forgiveness that actually mirrors Stoic forgiveness, but is the reverse. What do I mean? In Stoic forgiveness, you're forgiving the person without having them apologize or even change. You don't care. And in forgiveness is grace, you're doing the exact same thing. But in Stoic forgiveness, you're doing it because you want to be split apart from them. And in forgiveness is grace, you're showing them kind of undeserved love because you want to make an impact on them. You want to change them. Right, what's the usual dynamic? The person expresses remorse, you forgive them. Forgiveness is grace, you forgive them in order that they should express remorse. You're trying to create a domino effect inside of their heart to make them a different person. Now, before I talk about what I think of this model, it's interesting just to see it in the context of Western religion. There is a sort of stereotype, which turns out to be largely accurate, the Christian versus Jewish views of forgiveness. that encoded in the famous sort of phrase that everybody knows, turn the other cheek, which comes from the Gospel of Matthew. So there's a wonderful article by Miroslav Lobejchik called The Virtue of Hate, which is available on the internet, that he published about 12 years ago in the journal First Things. And in the article, Rabbi Soloveitchik narrates that when he was a student in Princeton Divinity School, he became friends with one of his classmates, a man he calls Father Jim. And in their weekly discussions together, he came to see that Father Jim's attitude to forgiveness is that everything is forgivable. Not sees everyone, right? That's the model of Christ. That's forgiveness as grace. This actually induced a very strong reaction in Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was, I think, quite horrified by this notion. And hence, the title of the article is an attempt to reflect what he believes to be the Jewish ethos towards these things, which is that, no, sometimes people merit being despised and should be hated. And in fact, it's a necessary prerequisite to justice that it's actually an egregious injustice to forgive everyone as if they were all on the sort of same moral scale. Anyway, I'll leave you
what's it called,
the virtue of hate. Okay. Well, three. Now, one of the things that he points out in the article, which is even to me more subtle, is Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower. In The Sunflower, Simon Wiesenthal narrates in a very short sketch how when he was in camp, in the war, it was a labor camp actually, he was brought to the bedside of a dying Nazi, a man who had killed hundreds of Jews, a heinous individual. And the Nazi wanted absolution, wanted forgiveness from a Jew, any Jew. So they literally bring Wiesenthal into the room. He stands over the Nazi. He narrates that there was a kind of fly on the Nazi's face and kind of brushed it away. Didn't say anything, and he left, and the Nazi died. Now, after the war, Wiesenthal is struck, I'm not saying with guilt, but with reflection. In other words, what should I have done? Did I do the right thing? Should I have done something different? He decides to write out the story and send it off to a series of Jewish and Christian thinkers. And that's the book, The Sunflower. The front end is the story, and most of the rest is the responses of these people. Very striking that virtually all the Christians who responded said, I understand your lack of desire to forgive him, but you should have done so. All should have forgiven him. All the Jews who wrote in said, no way you should have forgiven him. You can't forgive on behalf of other people, especially dead Jews. And Cynthia Ozick, in her classic way, referring to the fact that he brushed away a fly, said, quote, let him go to hell, better to fly to heaven than he. That was her response. The point being here again, that this notion of forgiveness as grace, where you give it out sort of undeservedly, which seems to be perhaps the theoretical Christian model, I'm in no way suggesting that like all Christians practice this kind of thing, but if that is the sort of theoretical doctrine,
they hold it to the ideal.
Exactly. It's not a Jewish ideal at all, in fact. Turns out not to be, not only does it turn out not to be a Jewish ideal, turns out to be a big mistake, according to Judaism, as we'll see in a moment.
Well, how would that case be grace, given that there is no domino effect? The guy's dying, you're not expecting to get anything in return.
Right, so you're right. And I don't know that Albert Hall would cite that as grace, but it's the notion of just giving it out.
Giving love into the world.
Giving love into the world. And the narration of that would certainly create impact on people's hearts and so on. You know, a lot of Christian testimonial is not really even about the person they forgave. It's about the people reading it who are going to be massively impacted and so on. And I think, you know, it's a tricky model because on the surface it seems like this is great. What an amazing individual that would do this. But the truth is that Judaism shows that this is a very problematic model for reasons I want to make really clear here. So to do that, let's turn forward a little bit to the last page, and then I can come back. Right? And look at source number 6. So I've said, yeah, go ahead.
Wait, I was going to say on top of what you said, I grew up in a predominantly Catholic city. Mm-hmm. And done that they can intervene to God on your behalf.
Right.
And, like,
right.
It's like, I think it's, I think priests are supposed to have like a
right, and there's a formula that they give you in that absolution, staggeringly not Jewish models, I'll point out in a second. but look at the Rambam, and look what he says in the Chodeo. To me, this is actually one of the most profound teachings in the Rambam, even though it seems utterly simple. He says the following: whoever hates a fellow Jew in his heart, transgresses a Torah prohibition, right? Don't hate your brother in heart. When one person wrongs another, the latter should not remain silent. Rather, he is commanded to make the matter known and ask him, why did you do this to me? Why did you wrong me regarding this matter? Let's just pause there. I meet many people, many, many people, who think that the essence of righteousness is to basically do a version of, no, it's okay. I don't mind. They think they're being magnanimous. That's a big mistake. If you want to be magnanimous in life, be magnanimous on the back end. And you've actually expressed what you felt, received an apology, and given forgiveness. Why do I argue that? Why do I argue that you should be magnanimous right away? Let's see. So for the Rambam, this is a mitzvah b'atzmah. In other words, it's a mitzvah for a human being to say to another human being and express their pain. And I want to come back to this because many people don't do this. I think there are very specific reasons why. Once that first step is accomplished, where you've made it known to somebody, you don't have to like scream and shout. You can say this calmly, you can say this however you want, but you've made them aware of how you feel. Once you've done that, and the Rambam says, if afterwards the wrongdoer asks the other to forgive him, in other words, he now apologizes, then he should. So there's a three-step process. You express it, they apologize, and you forgive. Okay. Now, what happens if you don't follow that process? What happens if somebody just jumps to number three, which is sort of forgiveness is grace? I didn't express my wrong, that you wronged me, you didn't apologize, and I'm just going to start out with forgiveness. I'm going to come right out of the box with number three. Let's take a look at Joseph and his brothers. So this is a wonderful scene. Right, it's in the beginning of Parshat Vayigash, after you all know the story, he's kidnapped by his brothers in chapter 37, and he goes down to Potiphar's prison, he comes up, he becomes second in command of Egypt, he's in charge of the grain rationing system during the famine, he's second in command of Egypt. As a consequence, everybody in the Near East has to come down to buy grain, including his brothers. He recognizes them, they don't recognize him. In the opening of Vayigash, he decides to reveal himself. He says, I'm Yosef, what I'm behind. I always think of this as Marlon Brando somehow. Joseph, is that false? Because partly what I'm thinking is that we have the hindsight of seeing this as a very kind of calm scene, but actually it's extremely threatening at the beginning. Because you don't know what he's going to do. Remember, his last notion of that is that they kidnapped him, they did this terrible stuff. So for the first four lines here, it's held a beautiful sort of suspense. I am Joseph, and my father's still alive. The brothers are like blown away, stunned, paralyzed. He says, come near to me, please. I still hear brother. And they came near, and he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Pause. So that moment, you don't know if he's gonna lower the boom on or not. And they said nothing. Then he whips to three. Don't be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. The famine has been in the land these 2 years. There are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and keep alive for you many survivors. It was not you who sent me here, but God. Very nice. So what's missing here?
Forgiveness, the
apology. Apology is missing. What else is missing?
And I'm sorry.
What's the first thing that's missing? The very first thing.
The wrongdoing.
Even before that.
What?
Yeah, expression of pain. Guys. How do you know what you did to me? So, of course, they don't apologize, right? There's collusion going on here. So, Because I actually think he doesn't want to have the conversation, and it arises all sorts of painful memories. So he's willing to skip by. They're super thrilled not to be called out on the carpet. So you think it's a good thing. This is the key. You think that when you're the injurer and you get let off the hook, that it's your get out of jail free card. But actually, it's the worst day of your life. Because you are, as they were, haunted by the sure knowledge that they had not earned it. And they never shook the feeling that maybe he still can't stand this, because they never went through the painful process of seeing him express what he felt and actually having to apologize. And the proof is very clear in source number 8, at the end of Rashid, the last group who came in partial by he, when Joseph's brothers saw the father is dead, because Yaakov has died now, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. Sorry, did I miss something there? 15 years of problem. Supposedly it's all hunky-dory, he gave them forgiveness as grace, it's all fine. It never took. And it never does take. And that's why the Rambam is so insistent that you must express it. And they must apologize, because there is a kind of process that human beings need to go through, both the injurer and the injured, that is inexorable. And the feeling that you're being magnanimous is a way of just condemning them to never feeling like they did what they were supposed to do. It's also your way of getting around a painful conversation. I just want, before one sec, I said before, you can be magnanimous on the back end, not the front end. That means that once they've apologized, so run on this counseling, magnanimity, so forgive them. If you feel you can, if the timing is right for you, which is complicated. But at the front end, just to give it away as grace, not actually doing anybody a good turn. Yes, ma'am?
Yes, but according to that logic, wouldn't it make more sense to do forgiveness as grace for like these pathologically evil people, because they're not going to have that, they're likely not going to have this sense of haunting remorse later.
You're right.
So maybe we'll just do it.
You're right. It's a great point. And that is exactly the Christian view. In other words, we're going to give it away whether they recognize it or not, whether they change or not. But the Jewish view is not simply that you forgive people in order to induce change. That would be wonderful. In other words, that's the ideal model. You forgive them, they see what they did, they grow a little, you grow a little. But what Rabbi Soloveitchik points out in that article, which many sources point out, is that there's also just the question of deserved justice. Right? In other words, do you earn what you get? If you don't earn what you get, that creates a very troubling paradigm where everybody's moral status is the same. In other words, if I'm Mother Teresa and I get to heaven, and I'm Adolf Hitler and I get to heaven, so that creates a very topsy-turvy moral universe, because you're not really being judged on what you did, since I'm going to get forgiven anyway and I'm going to get to where I need to go. So Judaism believes that there has to be a kind of responsibility, and one of the things that Rabbi Soloveitchik points out is that this can be traced to the founding moments of each religion. Right? What's the founding moment of Judaism? The covenantal responsibility that's endowed in Sinai. I will give you a gift called the Torah, and you have to live up to its responsibilities. That's talking about a reciprocal interaction. You have to earn your grace. What's the founding moment of Christianity? Jesus comes, unbidden, unasked for, dies for you without any input. I'm going to die for you, for your sins. You get a freebie. So what's really fascinating about that is that he traces, I think, brilliantly the idea that the paradigm set by the founding moment of religion. From the beginning, Christianity is organized around basically giving it away as an act of grace, and Judaism is organized around the idea
of a contract.
I'm going to give you this, there are privileges, there are responsibilities, but you have to earn it. And the reason you have to earn it is that we don't want this topsy-turvy moral universe where everybody can earn it without actually doing anything. That's the central concept of mitzvah, is that you take on a certain moral obligation upon yourself, that it isn't just like you live a terrible life and it's all okay because, you know, God loves me. But my point here earlier was just simply to say that the Torah is actually condemning the forgiveness and grace model here in this narrative by pointing out that even though Joseph felt he was doing a good turn, although I'm arguing that he had subconscious reasons of his own for avoiding the painful conversation, it didn't work. because there is a need to go through this kind of process. But I want to return to the notion of why, in so many cases, we don't go through suffering. We don't express the pain, because I think that is fundamental.
Well, just it puts the onus on the wrong party to start the conversation.
Ah, what do you mean the wrong party?
The party who was
aggrieved.
Why are they the wrong party?
The aggrieved
party. Right, why are they the wrong party to start the conversation?
Wrong.
Because something was done to them.
Right, and therefore?
Well, they're the one carrying the burden of this injustice.
And why shouldn't they just go to the person and say, you did me an injustice? Right?
Because to be validated, you're waiting for the offender to come forward and say, to initiate it.
What's wrong if you go to them and you say, and then they get, and then they validate?
Well, it's sort of... it's less gracious, for lack of a better word.
I think it feels to people outrageous. See, I think one of the most common attitudes we have, and it's actually can be a very destructive attitude, is this feeling of, why the hell should I have to say anything? You know what you did. It's outrageous, and I should tell you, we're so outraged by the obtuseness that we actually magnify the issue. It's like that old joke. It's usually told better when it's vulgar, but I'll make a cleaner version. The guy's car gets a flat tire in the desert, and he has to walk a couple of miles to the town, and he needs a jack for his car. So he's weighing out the arguments. He's afraid that he's going to knock on the door, and they're going to look at him, who is this guy, and slam the door, and he desperately needs this jack. So he's going through the argument, and the counter-argument, and back and forth, and he finally gets there. And he's like, in a fury pitch, and he knocks on the door, and this very nice person opens the door and smiles, and says, hi, can I help you? And he goes, keep it. Jack. I love that joke because it's very profound, right? It's like you have basically preempted it. Like, that's the other piece. The keep the bloody jack joke is about the fact that you are aware of the fact that asking, telling the person what they did is wrong. Because what might they do?
I don't see it that way.
They might tell you to keep the jack. In other words, they might tell you, I don't see that. I didn't do anything to you. Right, so now you've added like pain to pain. Right? So I believe that the two major reasons why people often do not express this thing in the first place is number one, because you feel they should know already, and number two, because it's a risk. Because in every act of expressing emotion to another person about being harmed, you are risking their rejection. You're risking them their non-recognition. You're risking their obtuseness. These are very powerful motives for people. The fear of rejection, again, the fear of rejection and the feeling that they should know already are great contributors to important conversations between people, especially family members, not happening, not getting started. Sir?
There's a third reason, and that is people seek to avoid confrontation.
But see, I think that third reason is really underlying others. Why do they seek to avoid conflict? Because conflict means essentially that there could be non-validation of their position, there could be rejection of their position, and so on, right?
It's just ugly.
But it's ugly
because you're making yourself vulnerable.
I think that in families, good conversations often happen not because they're smooth, but because after the painful sorting out of the issues, they come to an understanding, and there's a deep sense of grace there, of reconciliation, because it's been hard, and it's been painful, and there have been tears, and there have been questions, but the articulation of what disturbed me has been made on both sides, and after a lot of work, each side has finally come to see the view of the other, and there's a deep sense of having worked through something very hard. Actually, there's an enormous satisfaction when that happens. But if you pull back the tape, and after all of that struggle and arguing and talking, the other person still emerges as a brick wall, and you feel none of it is worth it. You feel doubly traumatized. It was even more painful. So I think there's meaningful kind of conflict that leads to a higher understanding, and there's almost senseless conflict, where it's just conflict for conflict's sake. Nobody's really thinking about the other person's position. It was kind of faded from the beginning that I didn't care about your position.
and so on. All right, so just to, yeah.
I have a question about the other way around. So say the wrong, the person who did the injuring, they come to the person that they injured and they express remorse immediately without being prompted. And that even though there might be miscommunication, for example, or issues underneath it, that the person who did the injuring is the person who comes first.
Yes.
And then they're standing at a brick wall. So is it the injurer's responsibility to continue, but they don't want to have, like, for example, like, say they might not want to have anything to do with you, they just want to deal with it themselves, that problem, but you want reconciliation for that, what you did, or for what you said.
Right.
Is it your is it the injurer's responsibility to seek them out?
So you're raising a very good point, excellent, really, and let's stay with it for a second. So the first thing is that the fantasy of everybody's life is that you start at step number two. Right, because that way, the person steps up, takes responsibility. You didn't have to express the pain, but they're accountable. That's everybody's fantasy partner. I didn't have to say. You know, the person that comes to you and says, you know what, I've been thinking about what I did, it was just awful, I'm really sorry, I feel terrible. You're like, oh my God, that's fantastic. You know, because you've got, the person's accountable without you having to go through this awful process. The problem is that it's relatively rarer. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen so often. That's A. B, you're talking about what happens when the injurer's plea to be forgiven is rejected, right? So that's an interesting point, right? Most people, especially in sort of Dati circles, have kind of memorized this kind of formula, you ask three times, and if they don't forgive you at that point, it's on them, which is the Rambam protocol. The problem is that that's pretty sideways to the reality of a lot of human pain. Human pain is not a formula. You can't just come to people. You know, it doesn't even say, like, in what sequence. Like, at 9:05, I came to them the first time. At 9:07, I came to them the second time. And by 9:08, I had actually relinquished my responsibility in 3 minutes, right? It's absurd. So it's really sideways to human pain, which is a process. It's a wonderful, I don't have it here, but there's a wonderful sicha of Lubavitcher Rebbe, there's so many sichot that I don't remember, it's volume 28. Seriously. In which he talks about a kind of phased process timing of forgiveness. It's very interesting. He says, you know, first of all, it could take you a lifetime just to get to the first level. Forget about the second and the third. What are the three levels? The first level, and I love his candor here, he says, is that you don't wish the other person harm. In other words, what's your act of forgiveness? For 20 years, I want you dead. I hate you so much. There are people who feel that way. I want the person who did this to me gone. I won't shed a single tear. They got run over by a truck. You finally reach the level of, I don't want to see you, you're not my friend, we're not reconciling, but I don't feel that kind of corrosive, toxic, acidic anger to you where I want to harm to you. I'm willing to let you go. And that's a level. For some people, that's quite a level because of the hurt that's been done to them. That can take a long time. If you go to that person who's been hurt that badly the next day and say, you know, I read in the Rambam that you should be forgiving me now, and you do it three times, you can forget it. You can forget it. It's not good to simplify that halakha. The second level, says the Rebbe, is that you genuinely, you still don't want anything to do with them, but you basically forgive them. You let them go. It's not even just that you don't wish them harm, you're willing to pardon them. And belief. And that third level is really reconciliation, which really means model number three, mature forgiveness, where you're really understanding and there's empathy and there's reciprocity and you're understanding each other, and that can take a very, very long time. So in terms of your original question, what happens when the injured comes and hits a brick wall? You know what? You're going to have to kind of expect that sometimes. And it's all contextual. How bad was the thing you did? What was the timing involved? So on your point, let's move back, because I want to talk about this point of timing, to a previous page. Take a look at source number two, and then we'll look at number three. Okay, so we talked about the Catholic model, the well-known Catholic model, right? That we go to the priest for absolution, and of course I said that's staggeringly not Jewish, because it really isn't, and we see that in source number two, with very famous Mishnah Yomah, right, in which Elazar ben Azariah
talks about beginning, you know, Hashem, you're going to be, you know, all your sins are going to be forgiven, you'll be clean, which is a pasuk we say over and over and over again on Yom Kippur. The sin towards God, Yom Kippur atones for, the sin towards man, it does not atone for till the neighbor has been appeased. Simple teaching, hard to carry out, right? In other words, don't pray to God, don't say a single word to God about something you did to somebody else. Doors closed. And the reason I love this Mishnah is because in so many cases in life, people circumvent the people they should be talking to. This is a favorite in families, right? Father does something to Junior and talks to Sister. Junior does something to Mother and goes to Father. Because everybody really wants to circumvent the real point of pain, which is addressing it with the person you did it to. So everybody finds dynamics to kind of deal with things in families around the central issue. But that isn't how it can go. And the mission is very clear about that. You have to deal with the people that are dealing with. That's it. But sometimes, even if you're well-intentioned, it's the wrong time. And you have to be cognizant of it. Hence this very bizarre but very interesting Gemara Yoma in source number 3. It's 3 stories in a row, without any kind of maskana, any kind of real version of the Gemara, but what's going on with it? They're all talking about people who, in a way, try to kickstart the process of forgiveness. And they're actually the people, in one case, the person who did the wrong, but in another case, the person who was wrong. So Rabbi Abba once had a grievance with Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah must have done something to Rabbi Abba. So he, Rabbi Yirmiyah, went and sat down at Rabbi Abba's door. I think that's really interesting. Right? What doesn't he do? He doesn't knock. He doesn't cross the threshold. It's kind of talking about a half apologizer. You know, it's like those bad movies where, you know, a couple have a fight and the guy gets in his car and drives around at 3 o'clock in the morning around her house, you know, and then parks across the street and looks up and, you know, thinks about where is she and I should be, for, you know, asking, but he doesn't actually knock on the door, you know. So Rabbi Yirmiyah, sort of sitting at the door, doesn't come in and say, I'm sorry, but I did this to you. Anyway, the maid pours out dung water, basically like toilet water, and some of the drops hit him. And then Rabbi Abba comes out and says, uh-oh, now maybe I have to apologize to you. That's where the story stopped. Rabbi Zerah, when he had a grievance against a certain person, he would pass them by repeatedly and show he was willing to reconcile so they would come out and appease him. Ah, so this is very interesting too. Rabbi Zerah's method is you make yourself available. So you're at a party, and the person who did terrible things to you at the other side of the room is there, and you like do everything to avoid them. But no, Rabbi Zerah would pass right by. It's like, I'm ready to do this. Say something to me, you know. So you think, oh, and there's no judgment here of the Talmud. Is this a good or a bad thing? But then comes the most fascinating story of all, and there seems to be an implication in the last story. It's about Rav. Rav had a grievance with a certain butcher. The butcher had done something bad. The butcher did not come before him to reconcile. Butcher's like obtuse, doesn't say I'm sorry, nothing. Yom Kippur is coming. Erev Yom Kippur, Rav thinks, you know what, I'll go to him. I'll do like a Rav Zerah move. I'll come in, you know, then I'll have an opportunity to apologize to him. He meets Rav Huna. Rav Huna was a student. He meets Rav Huna along the way. Rav Huna says, where are you going, master? He said, to appease so-and-so. Rav Huna said to himself, uh-oh, I was about to cause someone's death. Wow, really bizarre. If you go to that butcher, someone's going to die, says Rav Huna. So he goes to the butcher. The butcher is chopping an animal's head, which is what butchers do. Rav came and stood over the butcher. He raised his eyes and said to him, you're Abba, I have no grievance with you. In other words, get out of here. I don't have anything to do with you. And he chopped a bone. The bone fell into his throat and killed him, which can only happen in the Talmud, you know. But in any case, he dies. Now, there's lots of different ways of thinking about this story. I don't know if there's like any kind of one truth here, but it does strike me that there's a subtle teaching here about not pushing it when it's not ready. You know, and Rav Huna somehow sensed, no, don't go there. It's bad news. He's not ready. He's not going to act appropriately. So, you know, when you talk about the injurer trying to get forgiveness from the injured or the other way around, there has to be a certain kind of emotional sense here. right? You can humor yourself that you're really righteous by passing by and saying, you know, we should really talk about it, and you feel great about yourself because you were the one who was injured, and you're coming to them to talk about it, but it's actually not a good move because you're just flying in the face of the obvious, which is they're completely not ready. So there has to be, you know, some things are just not halachic. There has to be a kind of in-between-the-spaces sense about whether this is the right time to do this thing. And I think the Gemara lays it out as an agadah, as a kind of narrative, just to clue you into the idea that even though the Mishnah, because it's following the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah talks about, you know, sins between people, you've got to go deal with it yourself. So it's interesting. Right after giving that like black and white case law, it gives us these stories. I think the stories are there as a kind of commentary on the law to let us know it's not a simple law. There's also just the context of who is this person, what did they do to you, what's the timing, are they ready, are you just going to create more bad feeling, like all of this kind of goes into it. All right, lastly. Source number four. What constitutes tshuva? We'll play a little game here. I'm going to read out the Rambam and tell me if you like it. Rambam says that repentance involves three distinct steps in the following sequence. Number one, that a sinner should abandon his sins. You stop doing it. Number two, remove it from your thoughts. Number three, resolve in your heart, I'm never going to do this again. One, two, three. Stop doing it, remove it from your thought, resolve not to do it again. Do you like that sequence?
Yeah.
You do? Anybody put it in a different order? You don't. Tell me your order you would.
Well, number one's fine. Stop doing it. I guess I could keep that first. Okay. But the second one, resolve it in your heart, then you're still thinking about it. So if you remove it from your thoughts, how can you be removing it from your heart?
So you want,
have to think about it.
You want resolving it, resolve never to do it again second?
Yeah, and then
remove it third.
Third.
So you want one, three, two.
Yeah.
So anybody is else?
Like, is this like a nether, like saying like I'm never gonna do it again?
No. It's not involved in the formal halachot of the nether and shmua and all that.
I think it should be 2-3-1.
Oh, okay. So think about it, start thinking the process of not doing it, resolve not to do it, stop doing it. 2-3-1. Okay? Any other sequences? Some people, a lot of people I've spoken to, like 3-1-2. Resolve never to do it again, then stop doing it, and then remove it from your thought. Why does the Rambam go 1-2-3?
It's faster.
Okay. Why is it faster?
Because it could take someone like a lifetime to do three, and then another lifetime to do two.
Right. He's worried about what happens to a person when he thought overcomes action. There are people who ruminate a lot about their changes. They spend a long time with best intentions. They're planning, they're thinking, you know, when I quit smoking and when I do, you know, and they spend a lot of time thinking. And they spend a lot of time planning, they spend a lot of time resolving. Resolving can take 10 years. One of the things my mom is pointing out here is you want to stop doing something, stop it. Don't think about it. Don't go into a whole long thing. After you stop it, you can start thinking about all of the reasons why you do it. But at some point, there has to be a cut in the cycle. You want to stop gossiping, you know what you do? Stop gossiping. And if that means that you're in a room filled with people who gossip, and you want to stop, then clench your teeth for an hour. That would be his advice. Just sit there like that. Don't think about, you know, why should I get into gossiping? Just say, no, just stop it. Right? So he's got a certain kind of cognitive CBT thing going on. You know, where he is actually advising that at a certain level, change happens by changing, not by eliminating that change. Now, he doesn't eliminate the two steps. He's saying to you, then you have to think very carefully about, like, why is this in your mind? Why are you preoccupied with it, right? And then, at some point, you have to resolve not to do it again, right? But if you think about any kind of, I mean, things like addiction are more complicated in this sense. But I guess, I mean, I don't know, but I guess for the wrong ones, you're a porn addict, so he's saying just stop looking at porn, you know? Stop, don't think about it, like, I resolve not to, you know, just at some point, do it. Do the thing, whatever the thing is.
that you have to move to action at a certain level. Lastly, number five, there is a well-known mission about a common, you know, just basic tort law that if you damage something, you owe somebody the money after you pay them the money. But the mission, the Rama codifies this, says that restoring the money to the person, like you scratch their car, so you might give them the money, it's not enough. You have to apologize, to say something to them. Why? So, you know, there is a phenomenon with certain people, it's what I call buying off your apology. There are people who are so afraid of the actual contact, the human contact, of they're so paralyzed by admitting they were wrong, that they'll do anything to get out of that situation. So they'll try, in a way, substitute things for it, right? And a friend told me when he was a kid that his father would do something wrong, it was obvious to everybody, you could bet that night he'd come home with a little present. He'd never say I'm sorry. My friend remembered this for decades, right? That's why he had an ambivalent attitude to gifts, actually, because he associated that with, like, buying off your emotional life. Like, we won't talk about what Daddy did this morning, because isn't it nice, the new little thing that he bought me? That's exactly what's going on. And the Rama is basically saying you cannot substitute currency. Like, you can't substitute monetary currency for emotional currency. But there has to be a one-to-one kind of relationship between these things. Anyway, just some things to think about.
If it's a person's responsibility to owe money, like to give money to like something that like I don't know that they damaged. Is it up to them to insist?
No, there's a sort of set tort law that if you do a certain kind of damage to a certain kind of municipal property. That part's not in dispute.
What if they say no?
Well, so then the person's going to take them to the court and they're going to adjudicate.
The wrong person
doesn't want to accept the money, and that's a whole other area. It's not really pertinent to the issue here. What he's trying to say is that paying it off isn't enough. You're asking some kind of. Yes, sir.
What are the instances where I'm paying, you can't forgive the pedophile,
right?
But you can't understand this person. In other words, forgiveness doesn't come into it at all. The rules of the game are changed in life. Not with a sociopath, a person who is gripped for all sorts of psychological reasons or neurological reasons by the intent to do harm, and who doesn't.
It depends who you are in that sort of dynamic. I mean, I can sit here and remove and look at somebody and say that's their psychopathy, and that's fine for me, but if you've been sexually abused by this person many years, so you could understand it all you like, but the pain is so overwhelming.
The pain is there, but I don't think the word forgive comes into play at all.
No, for that person, nothing comes into play. There's a famous quote from Claude Lanzmann, director of Shoah, in which he said, I don't want to understand the Nazis, because if I understand them, I may have to forgive them. You know, like in other words, there's a certain point where even understanding is inappropriate, you know, at that level. Yeah.
So then Rabbi Zeldovich speaks of the virtue of hate.
Yes. Read the article. Don't talk to me until you're period. All right, thanks very much.
Okay.